Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about Southern Rust. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at some open source drone technology. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of Southern Rust. And in our Cool Beans That's Corny, we'll have some current events. Wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Getting chilly out there.
It's that time of year. Calendars turn into December.
I'm finally going to get some snow that might actually stay for a little while.
Got your soil sampling done? Todd,
so.
You got it all done?
Yeah. Do you ever have it all done?
No.
But you got most of it done. What you got to get done is done, and then I still had enough corn on in places or different things that, no, it wasn't all done, but we got to where...
I'm under triple digits.
Yeah.
I'm like at 95.
Yeah, when it's under 100, then yeah. It's, yes, then you're fine. Then you might as well call it done.
Yep.
So, no, it was good fall.
Yeah, weather-wise, it was good for harvest, good for sampling most of the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, Thanksgiving was good. You guys had a good Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always the best. Thanksgiving's just the best. There's football. There's good food. So, can't beat that. But haven't heard many deer hunting stories. Just seems
it's
like
been it's, quiet.
Yeah.
Opening weekend was a little slow for us anyway. I mean, there were a few people around us, like the neighbor pulled one out.
Pulled one out. That's what you call it.
Yeah, he heard shots, then could see him dragging it.
Okay, got it.
Excuse me.
So I'm doing. See, that's the, like, for me, like, I was just thinking about that Saturday when it started. Like, sit out in the woods, then you got to shoot it, then you got to drag it, then you got to gut it. I mean, it's a lot of work.
Usually you do that the other way around. Gut it first, then drag it.
See,
it's lighter that way.
I have no idea what I'm doing, so I was spoiled deer.
It's a lot lighter
to
drag a...
I was out soil sampling the other day, and there was a rib cage and some guts in the field.
Nice.
In the middle of the field, so I probably should let the farmer know that.
Was there some coyotes around it or not?
No, it was, you could tell someone placed it. It was too, like, close together to be.
Sure.
I'm sure the guts will be gone by spring, but the two rib cages might not do well with his bean planter.
Is that normal to take the rib cages out, Matt?
It's just a rib cage.
Well, yeah, they probably just, after they cut it up, they dump the rest of it out there. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you skin it, cut the meat off, and then you get the bones. That's all that's really left.
Yeah, I feel like most people think about the hunting part. They don't think about the
not
butchery.
The aftermath.
Yes, yeah. There's like a, now you have to butcher and process a deer.
Well,
or multiple deer, but usually you got a group with you, and that's probably better. And
the upside with the colder weather is you don't have to do it quite as quickly.
Right.
Like when it's warm out, it's going to spoil if you leave it too long.
Yeah,
so
it's cold now, so
do it pretty
now
fast.
You can hang it and leave it.
If you're bow hunting in October.
Oh, especially this last year, I mean,
yeah.
It was so warm, you'd have to really, really be on it to get it out of there.
My favorite is driving through Cecil at the boat launch. There's a dumpster.
Okay.
And it's like plastic bag, like a big plastic bag lined, and it says deer
carcass.
Carcass. You could dump your deer carcass.
Who's putting the county or like?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
Probably DNR has there or something.
Yeah, at the county at the SEMA garage, DNR's got like a spot you can put in. I think that's to track CWD.
Yeah, you can. There's spots all over for that where you can dump. Dump the heads for so they can check for CWD and all that.
But Black Friday's here. Do you guys get excited for Black Friday, or is it?
It's been Black Friday for like a week and a half.
Right, yeah. True.
Like month and a half.
I think Amazon's been running Black Friday deals for at least almost 2 weeks. And yeah, like I don't think it's. I think there's still people that go, and like go crazy, but just does like
it's not like it used to be, is it?
The deals run constant now for the month of November, it seems like.
Remember when it like crept, like it used to be for sure everything opened Friday morning at like 6 to 8 a.m. you know, like, yep. It was, and then it kind of creeped back to Thanksgiving night and moved, it just moved around, and then now all of a sudden like all the online things just, it's all more online now,
right.
Yes, than being physically waiting there for everything to open and stuff. So
there's no fighting over a Cabbage Patch doll like there used to be.
No Tickle Me Elmos. The one time I had to work Black Friday, it was
Menards
midnight. Yeah, I worked at Menards.
Well, that's
they terrible. Have Tickle Me Elmos at Menards.
They did not. It was, this was past the Tickle Me Elmo time. And Menards, like, that was kind of what I thought was the joke of people even showing up to Menards. And there were lots of people that showed up, but it's a lumber and, like, home good or home building supply store. And they would just buy this random stuff for Christmas. Like, they'd have weight benches.
Oh, like Menards.
GPSs and stuff. Yeah.
Oh,
so they
would buy stuff they never normally
stuff
carry.
They don't carry any other time of the year, for specifically for Christmas. For Black Friday. Then you get people in that would like swoop in and just like go nuts over this stuff. And it
buy three weight benches.
Like off brand and yeah, just this whatever they could find.
It's probably the plastic sand filled weight.
Right.
Or those old ones.
But the worst I saw on that particular Black Friday was they had an end cap that was all batteries, and it was like 40 AA, AAA, whatever batteries.
Like big boxes?
Like $2 or something. Okay. Stupid. Like it was really cheap.
Were they Rayovac or just some off brand?
They might have been Menards Rayovac. They weren't like Energizer jerseys.
Right.
They were some
still
second tier brand, but if not third tier. And that, like, the shelf was askew, like the signs were ripped off. Like people, it was animals. People were animals. They were just, they like destroyed the end cap to get the stupid batteries. And yeah, it was, you would think like a tornado rolled through.
The one time I ever went Black Friday shopping, I did go to Menards, ironically.
That's great. And buy batteries?
No. Okay. I wanted a ladder. They had like a, this one kind of ladder where it folded out and you could do different.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of them.
The little giant or the.
Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah, one of them. And I went like at 11. I'm like, it can't be that bad. Wrong.
No, it's everybody shows up and they're in the store for maybe like 20 minutes and then the rest of it's waiting in line.
Yeah.
Like that's the other half of Black Friday.
And it was a lot of. I went a couple years and years ago, went a couple times with like Nick. Our brother Bill, our other brother,
yep,
would go in and Adam, and we'd wait. And it wasn't the waiting. It was you'd wait to get stuff, and then you'd have the checkout line. It was, yeah, just insane. I don't know if self-checkouts fixed that. I'm sure it hasn't, or if people walk around with things to get you out of there. But
well, in that scenario, with a self-checkout, you've still got to have somebody watching those, that people,
right,
are just like walking out with stuff.
Right. The hardest part that day I went to Menards was parking.
Right,
sure.
Like I went to the one in like Darboy, and I had to park in the Taco Bell across the road, which I went to Taco Bell then, so that was good. But
yeah, yeah. The year I worked it, I think they threatened to tow at least half a dozen vehicles because people would just like
nice.
Somebody would drop them off at the door and just sit there with
at
the vehicle
door.
Running like at the door. Yeah, and the managers had to go be like, "Look, either you move it or you get towed. Like this is not." A parking spot.
Was there people in the car?
Yeah. Somebody was
just sitting there.
Like the driver was just sitting there.
Oh, that's
and
that's a bold move, Cotton.
Yeah.
Yeah, but think of like the day of the doorbusters. Like that's just done, isn't it? Like that's not a thing anymore.
Yeah.
Like the crowds aren't like they used to, which would probably be nice, and it's more, yeah.
Although we
more
did
online.
Go into Best Buy a month or so ago. And there was just stacks of TVs everywhere.
Sure.
Best Buy's still around.
It is. Yep. They probably do more online sales anyways.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of it is online. I mean, there's still probably a people that go on Black Friday. But Yeah. The only other time I ever like shopped on Black Friday, I did the same thing. I went later in the morning. I got whatever I wanted. But yeah, I was just waiting in line for probably an hour.
Right. Well, and then coming up on Monday is Cyber Monday, which now I feel like this is all Cyber Monday's taken over. It's, yep.
I think Cyber Monday is like Cyber Week now, right, or something. Like, it's not even a Monday anymore.
Is Small Business Saturday, is that still a thing?
I think so.
That's good.
Well, I can see where they had the Shop the Block.
Yep, that was that last weeks ago. Yeah.
2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And that was good weather for that, and it sounded like good turnout. So that's good.
There's everybody's wife. I forgot it was going on, and I had to go get something, and it was like just hundreds and hundreds of women wandering town with the occasional guy who like looked lost and wasn't sure what he wanted.
He's probably just out for a walk. He's like, oh my God, what's happening?
You could have swore you were at a Target.
I didn't know. I wanted to get smoker pellets, and I went in to the smoker pellet store, and there's like a guy like looking in the window like he wanted to go in. But I don't think his wife was going to let him go in. And it was just kind of weird. Like, he was just kind of standing there staring. So.
Did you sneak him some smoker pellets out? I did not. Like a electric bike? Or a, what else does the smoker store have there?
I had to go around the block. Or, well, more than a block. Because there was, like, nowhere to park. And then when I came back, luckily there was a spot open. And I was able to, like.
It's a big day in Seymour when there's nowhere to park.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought, too. I also didn't want to carry like a couple bags of smoker pellets further than I had to.
Yeah, very far.
When every other day of the year you could pull up right in front of
his literally be right there.
Fair.
All right, speaking of Black Friday, that's what it feels like when you leave a Southern Rust field on a Friday.
You feel like you're getting a good deal?
No, you're just covered in.
Are you thinking more of Black Tuesday?
It's more of a gold.
No, isn't was it Black Monday in the NFL when all the coaches get fired?
There's a Black Monday. Yeah.
There's Black Tuesday. That was the start of the Great Depression, too.
Ooh, we don't want that.
But I would think that would be, especially in Iowa, more what you would feel coming out of a cornfield with Southern.
Weren't you more rust tan?
It was more like a tannish. And itchy. Because it just, I don't know, it like made you itch. So today, I'd like to talk to you guys about is kind of a Southern Rust wrap-up. It feels like it's made a bit of a resurgence in the recent ag news and just sort of kind of what'll happen this year, like a retrospective, and then let's look into the future of what do we do about it for 2026. And
going all the way to the year 2000?
Yes.
The future?
The future.
Do you have a Southern Rust wrap today like you had a few?
No, that was, we're not doing the tassel wrap. No.
You just have listeners very disappointed now.
I don't think we do. I think they're fine.
There's a couple
no more wraps.
I know there's a couple that are disappointed. Right. And you know who you are.
So officially, I think we can call officially on the Tilth Talk Radio, we're going to call it that. The disease of 2025 and the official champion is Southern Rust.
Yep.
Like it beat out Tar Spot. I wouldn't even say like I thought it'd be close, but it crushed it. And then basically all the like Northern Corn Leaf Blight, everything else, to be honest, it almost like we didn't even hardly see it. Yes, there were other diseases there. I'm not going to say there wasn't. But when you look at how much when you look at the kind of final disease maps from the IPM pipe website, it basically, I mean, it made it all the way down to Florida, Texas, through the whole Midwest. About the only spot it really didn't go much is kind of the eastern into some of those areas that are kind of bigger corn areas. Like when we were in North Carolina, it really didn't have any in that area. So
you're saying Southern Rust was the Dodgers.
Yes. Southern Rust is the Dodgers. It's just everywhere. There's some areas where it, like, whole parts of Michigan where every county shows up, and then obviously Iowa, Nebraska, really, really a lot in Minnesota, South Dakota. So it just crushed. And bringing up last year's map, you can see there, South Dakota and Nebraska had a lot of it. And then there were spots everywhere else that maybe got a lot. And then the last year I could get where we had this much Southern luster was maybe close was 2021.
That was more east, though.
Right.
Indiana, Illinois.
Right. So it kind of, it's and then you bring up like 22, 23, and it really wasn't even around. So this year, officially the year of that, you go to the tar spot map, and there was tar spot out there, but it wasn't, it was almost like.
It came on really late.
It did, and like it almost, it was there in a lot of fields, but since Southern beat it, you know, got ahead of it and was a little worse, it was almost just like, oh yeah, you have some tar spot there.
Like,
yeah.
Meh.
Right.
Yeah, it's there.
It's there, but what do you, nobody's, it wasn't that bad. And it didn't seem to take out the yields like what the, like what Southern did. One of the hard parts was finding some real, so I wanted to find some actual data. Like we lost X amount of bushels across the whole corn belt, or we lost, and there really isn't that. There's kind of some reports on, and this I would say is what we maybe saw, but bad infestations, you lost 20 to 50 bushel. But that, how bad was it everywhere? And even some fields where I saw it earlier, some varieties I saw it early, they didn't really get it as bad as I thought they would. There's one particular variety that I can picture that had it early and looked really bad early, and then it almost like just
stopped. Yeah.
And it was one where we were going to take for silage, and then we decided to leave for grain, and I was like, oof, that might be bad, and it was fine. It made it fine.
We had a weather change there.
Correct.
That
cool down we got.
Cool down.
So, and I think that could help, like in Wisconsin, Minnesota, I think in even parts of Michigan, I really think that cool down helped us a lot because we didn't see those reports of, I mean, in general, Wisconsin, we're getting record yields, so we didn't have that top end get knocked off. Iowa, when I look at reports, Nebraska,
Iowa was probably the worst.
Hammered,
almost,
right,
yeah.
Right. Where they're seeing that sort of, especially a lot of them were using APHs. So they're kind of going, this is our normal APH. And looking on Ag Talk right now, and most of Iowa, they said, we're 30 bushel less than APH.
Ooh, yeah.
So just didn't really find as much data that way. Was how bad did it really hurt us? We don't maybe know that yet, but in the preliminary data that's coming in, we are seeing some loss. One of the spots that was interesting was First Trials. They were comparing last year's sort of all their trials to this year's, and I believe it was like about 1.9 bushel less. And not that that's all Southern rust, but part of that probably is.
Did you see any of your fields like significantly get above the ear placement in rust, or was it pretty much below?
Some, but it was pretty much below.
If it did, it was usually pockets. Like there'd be a spot in the field where it was like almost the whole plant.
And was, what I would say with
rows over
pockets too would be like literally like three or four plants in one, like very, they weren't even the, they were smaller than the size of the truck, you know, like, or they were very, very small.
Yeah, it'd be like three rows
yeah.
and a few plants down three rows. Yep. Then you go over three more rows and you wouldn't hardly see anything.
What I thought was interesting, I had a couple of spots with some very susceptible varieties next to the less susceptible, and you could really see those splits. And then late season, I couldn't see the splits as much. So it seemed like the susceptible varieties, it wasn't that the other varieties were less susceptible. They just maybe could hang on a little longer before they got it. They didn't get it as early. Was maybe one of the things that I had noticed. So moving on, let's just talk about what it is. And Southern rust is caused by a fungus. Matt, can you help me out with this one or not? You're the official
Puccinia polysora.
That was better than I would have said. And it's more considered a tropical disease. It's not as common in the United States, but it can occur in the corn production areas in the United States and Canada.
It likes it hot.
It likes it really hot. And symptoms are similar to common rust, but the pustules are smaller, and then usually they're more, they kind of erupt more out of the surface. And spores are orange when they erupt, and they become more of a chocolate brown to black, forming dark circles around the original pustule as it gets out there. So some of that later season stuff guys might have, in a way, blamed on tar spot, but it was really actually that southern rust just sort of changing over into the older pustule. And then how does it infect? And it basically starts in tropical regions, so like in Mexico, and then fungal spores are transported by north blowing wind, and basically they have potential to infect as they come in contact. And one good thing, one different thing is common rust, so we're just saying the regular common, that'll infect from 60 to 77 degrees. But, however, on southern, it likes it hot, like Matt said. It likes it 77 to 82.
And if you remember, 4th of July was really hot.
We were hot.
It was almost 90.
Yeah.
And then just Todd, looking back at the weather, there was a break, August.
It was later August.
18th. Yep. Was 66 degrees August 18th. And after that, it didn't hit 80.
Probably till September.
Yeah. Till September 14th. So it was a whole month there.
Yeah, we had a July that felt like a greenhouse.
Yeah.
And had those temperatures, and even the night temperatures stayed that hot typically. And so basically you can have a very active July and August when those temperatures are that high. And it does like a 6-hour moist period. So if you have heavy dew for 6 hours or rain, that wasn't a time where we were getting necessarily a lot of rain, but the 6 hours of dew is sufficient to cause that. So irrigation, obviously you want to watch that. And then as we're getting those dews, and we were getting that as well during that time, we were getting enough temperature fluctuation that we'd get dew plus those temperature. So it does, though, it doesn't need a lot of moisture to spread, and it can spread with very little moisture. So that's one too. You think of some diseases where you just need it really, really wet, like a 2019, and this one, it needs that wet period for 6 hours on the leaf, like a dew, but it's not like a lot of rains it's going to move it or anything like that. It's wind driven. So in really doesn't, it survives in the winter in tropical areas, and then it kind of comes back, and we'll get into that a little bit more.
Which makes sense, tropical, it's hot, moist, right.
And it,
humidity.
The name, to me, fits well, southern rust. It comes from the south. It's not anything that we get up here. So what other crops are hosts? And basically, it is very specific to corn and sweet corn. And then there is other things that can get it, but not any of we're getting more grass species we mix with alfalfa. None of those are going to be susceptible to it, or like our lawn grasses or just pasture grasses. They're typically not going to be susceptible. So one of them, the first host in the U.S. that was reported was eastern gamma grass. Don't know that I've ever seen eastern gamma grass. And then the Eranthus species, which sugar cane is sort of in that species, but it didn't seem like sugar cane was all that susceptible, but they're similar to sugar cane. So what is good in our area, and the first thing, so this is kind of thinking about next year, is we don't have a lot of co-hosts for this. We don't have something that corn is a host, and it's also a host and something else that might help it to make more of a problem. So really we don't have to worry about some sort of other host with that. So continuing on what we should worry about for next year, and that is, will it overwinter here? And
no,
we don't have to worry about it surviving. It needs green plant material to survive on. And the furthest north the corn is grown in winter is northern Mexico. And even that, it's more kind of Central America and the rest of Mexico. So things to think about with that is, will rotation help? And
it won't help or hurt.
Right, right. It's not going to matter.
So if you had a bad field this year, you have equal chances probably of getting it or not, just depending on the weather.
Right. And then will tillage help? And there again, not going to
really
matter.
Gonna matter. Yep.
So a lot of times when we think about disease, we think about residue management. How do we worry about that? And this in general really shouldn't matter. Our winters will take care of that problem. So that's something to think about for next year. Then the next thing to think about is fungicides and hybrid resistance. So let's talk about this year. Were there any reported fungicide failures? And, you know, is this some sort of created like a super species or something like that? And of all where it was used, fungicide was used, it did help. And from what we could tell, this is not becoming some sort of resistant disease. It's our fungicides actually in general work quite well with it. Obviously, there's certain fungicides that maybe work better than others. But this one, there's not some sort of, disease.
We did have fields treated with fungicide that did still have southern rust.
Correct.
You know, lower in the canopy.
In the lower canopy, yeah.
So one of the things looking into that, timing matters a lot
right. With
fungicide on it. And obviously, timing to when you're going to get the disease matters. So most likely what happened is it maybe helped some of that first flush. That was probably an earlier application, then a little bit came in later. But they're not finding like a resistance. But that's a good point, Bill, that you might have thought, well, I use fungicide, I don't have any of it. And that wasn't always the case either. And then looking forward to next year, hybrid resistance. So in general, it was, if you had a hybrid that was resistant to this, it did work really well. The hard part is this isn't typically in the book. It's not one that we really know. This year is going to tell you which ones maybe aren't as resistant and got it more.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of those that popped to the forefront, and maybe you use a little less of that genetic or spray that with fungicide or do something. But I would say use what you learned this year from the hybrids that got it.
And maybe if we start to hear of reports to the south and our weather looks warm and, you know, hot and humid and, you know, a lot of dews again, maybe you think about, and again, grain price isn't going to be good probably with the crops that we took off this fall, but maybe you consider spraying a little bit sooner, because like you said, Todd, if it's going to come on a little sooner, maybe you can prevent that infestation, and maybe you got to spray again, but at least maybe you can hold it off.
Yep. Yeah, to wrap this up, that's one of the take-home is this could be a one-off disease that we don't see in Wisconsin for, you know, especially a major infestation for another 10 or 20 years. But we might see it again next year. It just sort of depends on that weather that we get. So I think, Bill, that you summed it up well of depending on where you are, a lot of what I read said if you're in the Western Corn Belt, you're going to have to do a lot of more to consider that, like, how do I manage it? Because it's been 2 years in a row in Nebraska and South Dakota that they've gotten hit with it pretty hard. But does that mean they're going to get it next year? Maybe not. And then the Eastern sort of Corn Belt in general, this was probably a one-off, not as much of a problem. We even said, like, you go way to the East, that they didn't even really get it that much there. So this is a disease I think we got to keep in mind. However, it's different than a tar spot. It's different than some of these other diseases that we've
gotten. Right. Tar spot came from the south but then hung around, whereas this one so far has not been able to do that.
To overwinter here. So, yeah, and we'll have to keep watching it if it changes and it does become something that can overwinter or do something. It is making, and we'll get in the ag history minute to talk about that, but the progression it's making, it sort of has these decades where it seems to really push. And then it wanes for like two or three decades. So we could be in a spot here where it maybe pushes, the genetics maybe respond, you know, some of the corn companies start breeding back a little bit more resistance or something like that. And we get better. But I'm going to call it this year that for next year, we're in general going to be fine. And we're going to not hear much of Southern just because of all of what I just said. It doesn't overwinter here. We don't have a lot of hosts. That unless the weather's conducive to that, then this won't be a problem.
Shooting your shot?
I'm shooting my shot and saying that 2025, it won. Next year, we're going to see something completely different that we won't have that particular weather. It was like the perfect weather for it in July. It just everything clicked. It came up here, and
the same reason we had a really good corn crop is also the reason we had Southern Rust.
Correct. So maybe that's a good point, Matt. Is maybe we, for us in Wisconsin, especially in maybe Minnesota, we actually probably want the weather that's conducive to have this year, because that means we're going to get really good crops as well.
Right.
And we got lucky that the weather did turn in August when it did.
Well, we started cold, and we got that cold snap kind of toward the end.
Right.
That was good for pollinating corn through that window. But, we'll see what next year brings. But we needed the heat to catch up, but it also brought Southern Rust to us. So see what happens. All right, now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So open source drone technology will democratize precision agriculture. An interdisciplinary collaboration showcases Mizzou's leadership in advancing smarter farming with better data. So this article is kind of looking at some technology that Mizzou has developed, and at Mizzou, they are cultivating real-world insight to develop common-sense solutions and share with them with communities around the globe. Technological innovation from a pair of Mizzou engineering researchers will make precision agriculture faster and more accessible, unlocking opportunities for smallholder farms everywhere. Dewi Karismawati grew up in a small village in Indonesia, where her father and most people she knew worked the land. Each farmer only has a small field, and sometimes they can only plant and harvest enough for themselves, she said. I saw how hard it was, working from sunup to sundown in the tropical heat. Subsistence farmers like her father stayed on her mind when she came to Mizzou for a bachelor's degree in computer science and inspired her to stay for grad school. Chose agriculture as the application for her computer science skills because she wanted to give developing countries the tools enjoyed by the developed nations. She knew firsthand the risks inherent in agriculture. Adverse weather and volatile markets meant even large ag operations live on the financial edge, and for subsistence farmers, that threat is existential. Excuse me. So up until now, the ability of UAVs to monitor for mitigating risks has been somewhat limited. Meant spending lots of money on UAVs and GPS and sensors and everything else. And in just 20 minutes, you can collect a vast amount of data, she said. The challenge lies in processing that data. And so that's where she comes in with a process called mosaicing, where you would take images and kind of stitch them together. And so usually you have to buy a subscription or license for that technology, and she's helped develop DroneZaic, which is a consumer-grade drone technology captured without GPS. You can use preset flight paths or engineering support. Drone pilots can shoot nonstop video without GPS while adjusting speed and path as needed. Can fly as low as 10 feet and give them much better resolution, and it requires fewer frames and less time and processing powers than conventional softwares to build a clear, complete picture of a field, even in poorly lit conditions. As a result, users can generate accurate mosaics in minutes, not hours, with minimal setup or expertise. So the source code is available online. It also has a step-by-step usage guide designed for both developers and non-developers. So it's something that can be used with folks without the need for a license. So kind of interesting. We'll see how it works out and gets established. And now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So we've got Southern Rust and the historical movement of Southern Rust. It was first formally described and named in the U.S. in 1897, based on a specimen found on eastern gamma grass in Alabama. Historical records indicate that it was already prevalent in Central and South America prior to 1891. Later, SCR, or Southern Corn Rust, caused great concern upon its unexpected emergence in West Africa in 1949 and 1950, leading to severe academic epidemics that rapidly proliferated, resulting in substantial yield loss of up to 50% in Western Africa. SCR erupted aggressively in the rest of Africa in 1952, 1953. Outbreaks were reported in the Philippines, causing 80 to 84% yield loss. It was also later reported in Canada in 1954, and in 1957 was initially documented in India, where it caused mild infection. Disease was mostly observed in the lower Mississippi River Valley in the U.S. and was regarded as minor corn disease until 1972, when many outbreaks documented across several states from 1972 to 1979. In the 1970s and 1980s, SCR swiftly spread to Australia, Thailand, Japan, and China. And SCR is now regarded as a global disease due to its dissemination over 110 countries throughout Africa, Asia, the Americas, and Australia. Its latest advances, SCR was first reported in South Dakota in 2020 by SDSU, and in North Dakota in 2021. These reports that it was advancing northward and suggest it may be progressively acclimatizing to milder conditions in North Dakota, or that the climate in the Midwest may be becoming more conducive to southern corn rust. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that it got to North Dakota, I think, was a big hit. Really, this year there was no reports of it in North Dakota, but that one was kind of a shock. And then what I think is wild, that Europe, that we don't hear any issue. Just
a more temperate climate.
Right.
They have had some warmer summers in the last few years, but I don't think they consistently get to the high temperatures that it likes.
Right. So
they definitely have the moisture.
Yeah. Right, yeah, but like you say, it shows that the moisture part isn't as key as the temperature part.
Temperature, yeah.
So,
there is an ocean, too.
Well, but it's in Africa.
Fair.
I just thought it would have, and that one, too, it seemed like I said, when it was these decades, it seemed like in the 50s it really pushed, and then it kind of took a back seat for the 60s, and then the 70s it pushed again, and then I feel like now it's almost kind of back seat till about 2020 when there's, first saw it in South Dakota, reach that far, and then 21 in North Dakota, and we've kind of had these years since that where it's pushed again. So thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's real easy to find us. Just go to Spotify and search Tilth Talk Radio, and that will work on your iPhone or on your Android phone. You can also find us on your iPhone on Apple Podcasts. There again, search Tilth Talk Radio. You can listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now it's time to get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Consumers are hungry for what dairy and beef deliver. So major retailers like Walmart have data showing that an important statistic exists. Customers who have beef in their shopping cart spend 30% more. Understanding their customers and knowing the demand for high-quality beef is why retailers are working to crack the code on the fragmented beef supply chain. Sourcing beef is not only about volume, but the supply chain story. Consumers have an 80% affinity for retailers when the consumers know where their food comes from, according to Neil Mellers of Ranch to Retail, and he presented this at the recent Dairy Cattle Reproduction Council annual meeting. Mellers and the Ranch to Retail team are based in Arkansas, an important geographic location as the home of the corporate headquarters of Tyson Foods, Dillard's, J.B. Hunt, and the world's largest retailer, Walmart. Bentonville, Arkansas alone is home to 1,800 businesses across various consumer supply chains. Ranch to Retail is a consultancy group working with across the agriculture and cooperative beef supply chains. Mellers provides insights into why dairy beef cattle are set up for long-term success and addressed some key aspects what consumers are seeking. So among those, we're continuing to prioritize genetics, noted that across the supply chain, quality matters. Build and use the dairy beef traceability advantage. Excuse me, the being able to identify parentage and herd health, vaccination programs, colostrum use for calves, all kind of play into that. Seek feed lot and packer loops. Coordinated system looks for data feedback on carcass grade, yield, eating quality, and tenderness. Push versus pull, delivering what the consumer wants versus trying to create a push for something that has not been shown to drive demand. And positioning, so leveraging your position to make sure that you have what consumers want. So see where beef markets lead in the future here. All right, that's corny then this week. A lot of angry dairy farmers in Europe, and they are looking to stop feeding a additive known as Bovaer. So in Denmark, a number of dairy farmers are claiming their cows have been poisoned as a result of feeding the methane-reducing additive Bovaer. Several farmers have reported major health issues in their cows, including fevers, diarrhea, fertility and conditioning problems, cows collapsing, and even some that have died. Bovaer is a feed additive containing the active ingredient 3-nitrooxypropanol, or 3-NOP, which reduces methane emissions produced by cattle. Excuse me. Manufactured by Swiss company DSM Firmenich. It's designed to be added to cow feed in small quantities to inhibit a specific enzyme in the animal's digestive system. It's reported to cut methane production by as much as 30% in dairy cows. Regulatory bodies like the Food Standards Agency in the United Kingdom and the European Food Safety Authority have approved Bovaer for use in many countries, stating it's safe for consumers, animals, and the environment. And since October 1st, the Danish government made it compulsory for farms with more than 50 cows to add Bovaer to their dairy rations for at least 80 days out of the year. If farmers don't comply, they face heavy fines. But farmers like Anders Ring, who's 39 and milks 600 cows near the small town of Grettestedbro, just 3 kilometers from the North Sea on the southern Denmark coast. He has 123 hectares on his farm, or about 304 acres, and also rents other land. And so he runs a total of 700. He's got 600 cows and a 40-stall Bomatic rotary parlor that was installed in 2006. They have 3 barns, first built in 06, 2015, and 2020. They milk cows twice a day, 7:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. Each milking takes them about 4 hours, including startup and cleanup. And the herd is yielding about 24,353 pounds of milk per year, with an average of a 4.32% butterfat, 3.69% protein, and somatic cell of 255. They sell their milk to Arla, but he is one of the farms that's been seeing issues with the Bovaer, and he calls it poison, saying that he's lost cows, an explosion of digital dermatitis, and many bad reproduction cycles. So something to keep an eye on as they continue to struggle with that, and hopefully they'll find a solution, especially with, unfortunately for those farmers in Denmark, being required to use it. So, and now we'll wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. So Wisconsin farmers face storage limitations after a big corn crop. So the upside is lots of yield out there, but the downside is we're starting to run out of places to put it. And if you haven't seen it in the news lately, the United Cooperative, not too far from our world headquarters here in Seymour, was making a corn mountain out in the parking lot. They have 2 1.3 million bushel bins, filled those up, and we're taking more corn out into the parking lot. So United's overflow, their facility north of Appleton, has millions of pounds of corn temporarily stored in the parking lot. Their president and CEO, David Kramer, said multiple sites are facing similar circumstances because of storage bins being full. They're actively making space and moving grain. They've got rail freight coming in as fast as they can get it, and are trying to keep as much of it off the ground as they possibly can. Kramer noted that resorting to outdoor piles is rare and highlights how strong this year's crop has been. In some parts of Wisconsin, farmers are reporting unusually high yields. Some even talking about 20 to 30 bushels over their all-time record high yields in some areas. Local Extension crops and soils educator and friend of the podcast, Kevin Jarek, was quoted in the article as saying there's only been a few years when elevators become this overwhelmed. He recalls seeing similar scenes in 1994 and added that strong yields in the top corn-producing states like Illinois and Iowa mean rail transportation is limiting and therefore slowing grain movement. So,
1994, that's when Kevin Harkins back. We'll have to
Harkins back to 94.
Get him on and talk to him about 94.
He was in college.
Maybe he remembers the piles.
He does. If he remembers
yeah.
this stuff, like he remembers Packer trivia, oh, yeah, he surely
yeah.
does.
I'm sure he does. But, yeah, I mean, you see it every once in a while, but this year just more than ever, even talking to farms, I know, Bill, you've had some customers and, you know, just driving around, you can see corn in the field, and a lot of it's because they don't have anywhere to go with it until space opens up. So
they're saying one load a day they were getting.
Okay.
Ooh.
That's
and
rough.
And the piles are wet corn. It's not
right.
dry corn.
Dry corn, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the dry stuff is in the bin, and then right. they ship that out and have to run it through the dryer yet, too, so which that slows things down, depending on what the moisture of the corn is. So
my brother-in-law hunts near the large pile in Center Valley, and he was pretty pumped. It was a big bait pile.
Yeah,
I was gonna say how many deer were.
Yeah, I don't know. And those deer most likely are gonna get on the road, probably. But yes, true. It was just this giant.
Just have to set up some stands around the pile.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the co-op will like that.
Probably not. They probably don't want you shooting that close to their facility. All right, well that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about Southern corn rust and how prolific it was this year. May not be so next year. We'll have to wait and see as the weather is the driving factor behind how far that seems to make it. In our spotlight, we took a look at some open source drone technology for splicing your images together that's out there from Mizzou. Ag History Minute, we talked about the historical movement of Southern rust and how it seems to wax and wane as it spreads throughout the world at different times. And our cool beans this week, lots of positivity from retailers for what beef and dairy can do for their bottom line. Our That's Corny this week was the Bovaire additive being potentially linked to some issues in Europe. And our Field Good Friday is Wisconsin farmers, despite high yields, are seeing some limits in how fast they can move that corn out. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.